My guest, Bill Broshensky, shares inside stories of the healthcare system and aids that I have never been exposed to before. He speaks of taking a stand with the hospital where he worked, making efforts to implement more compassionate care of patients with AIDS. With every patient he cared for, he could see himself being reflected back to him. He made a deal with the universe, and the universe granted his wish. If you have ever felt like you are in darkness, with no light at the end of a very long tunnel, this episode is for you. Hello, Bill Broshensky, and welcome to the Authentic Gay Man Podcast.
Hello, and well, thanks for having me.
Well, and thanks for being willing to give me some of your time to do this. I have been excited to have a conversation with you, get to know you, and hear your story. And I know that the listeners will feel the same way.
Well, fortunately, I'm blessed to be retired finally. And I think this is the time in your life when you should be having conversations with people and giving your time.
I agree completely. I'm in the same boat. Well, just to let the listeners know how we know each other, we actually don't know each other. This is our first time to speak. We've maybe had a brief email exchange to set this up. Somebody in Bill's life told him about the podcast and suggested that he might be a good guest. And so he listened to an episode or two and then reached out and put his name in the hat as a guest. And here we are. So this is our first time to talk. And I know only what the topic of his story is about, but I don't know the story itself yet because we haven't gotten to that part. So before we jump in, Bill, I would love to know what it means to you to be an authentic gay man.
Wow, that's a big one. We could talk about that for an hour. Jeez.
Good.
Wow. That is an ongoing thing. I think authenticity in general is something I strive to achieve, but it changes daily, weekly. Changes who you're with. It's just a constant thing. And I just mentioned earlier, I'm fortunate enough to be retired. I'm also fortunate enough to be retired and being aware that as a person who now has a lot less external pressures to be some standard, whatever that is, and to interfere a little bit with my authenticity, like your job and family and parents and et cetera, et cetera. I'm in a beautiful position to really work on my authenticity and not apologize for it and not have as many external pressures to behave in a certain way. That is acceptable authenticity, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. So I hope that was a good answer.
Yeah, no, I get it completely. And I hadn't really thought of it, but yes, you know, as some of those external pressures leave our life when family passes away or when the job comes to an end, yeah, it does free us up to express who we are more genuinely and yes, authentically, beautifully sure. Stated. I love it. Thank you for that contribution. You know, it's amazing. I've gotten a gazillion different answers and they've all been correct. That's the beautiful. They've all been different and they've all been correct. There's going to be a book out of that, perhaps.
We are all uniquely authentic.
Yes.
Just yes. Let us be it, please.
Exactly. So to get down to our big topic, what we're here for, what has been the biggest challenge in your life, the hardest thing that you've gotten through or are still continuing to make your way through?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, I have had a life full of challenges, limitations, restrictions, not one trauma, but multiple traumas. I guess you could view it, I could view it as tragic or annoying, whatever way I want to go with that. But all of them collectively have made me who I am today. And so it talks to my strength and my character as a person who is a survivor. But the biggest one, and it's the one I chose to be the topic, then maybe you'll have me back to talk about some of the others, but it would be being a long-term survivor of HIV for more than 42 years. As a young gay man in his early 20s, who was just like in the honeymoon phase of coming out and saying, yes, I'm a gay person, and being authentically gay, within a very short time, a door was slammed in my face, or in the face of all gay men. And on that door was a sign that said, danger, danger, warning, warning. You may die because of your choices. There is a gay plague, a gay disease out there, and it's fatal. And what do you do with that information? How do you respond as a gay man? Do you run back in a closet? Do you bury yourself? I don't know. It was just overwhelming. I was feeling the highest of highs, and then the bottom just went out. And it didn't go out just like a floor collapsing. It was a deep, dark, continuous, ongoing motherfucking abyss. When you didn't think it could get deeper and darker and sadder and scarier, it did. And I guess uniquely for me, here I was a healthcare professional, a nurse who is all about healing and helping and saving the world, stamping out disease and saving lives. And here I was in a world, I was actually in the world of nursing and medicine that didn't handle those initial years very well. And I saw some of the most horrendous things going on in what was supposed to be a health care environment. And I saw people discriminated against and punished and tortured and isolated, and just was a frickin' mess. Those were not good times.
Well, and that's not a story we hear a lot of comments about. I mean, what you're saying right now is not something I've heard a lot of. I don't know that I have been really exposed to very many people that were in healthcare during that time and saw behind the lines. You know, we've all seen the documentaries that may or may not be terribly accurate. But some of what you're saying is, this is the first time I've heard that. I mean, I know in the very beginning, they didn't even know how it was transmitted. So we didn't know whether it was airborne or whether you could get it from touching or shaking hands with somebody. We didn't have a clue.
Yeah. And that's where the fear and the paranoia and the craziness went over the top. I was working as a nurse at Georgetown University Hospital, and I remember getting a couple of patients on our unit. It was an oncology cancer unit, and a lot of people had KS lesions, Kaposi sarcoma, and we didn't know much, and I get that, but I saw a lack of humanity. And I remember one of my head nurses saying to me, Bill, you're spending too much time in those rooms. You're going to get it. Whatever it was. And I'm thinking, I'm spending time in these rooms because these men are lonely and in fear and petrified, and they're going to die. That's why I'm spending time in this room. And she said, the longer you spend time in that room, the more you're putting other patients at risk. And I'm thinking, I'm taking all the precautions in the world, but it was her fear. And when people died, they threw away phones, beds, burnt mattresses. This was Georgetown University Hospital. And I'm sure other hospitals did the same thing, but that's where I was at that time. They threw away everything because it was contagious. Well, we didn't know it wasn't contagious. And then even after we discovered this is infectious, people still treated everybody like they were contagious. They were leopards for a long, long time. And then finding out, when I was at Georgetown University Hospital, I was actually part of a Western Bloc study. So I participated as a volunteer. And after the 10th time of having a positive Western Bloc, I said to the guy who was running the study, I don't think I need to know anymore that I'm positive. That's enough. But I realized I was positive while all this craziness was going on, and people would come in and they would get pneumonia and they would die. And it was tough. It was tough to be a nurse who was loving and caring and generous with my soul, my caring and my knowledge. And then to watch people around me treat people horribly. And yes, some of those documentaries don't do it justice, because I don't think the world would really want to watch that. It was bad enough living it.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. So Bill, during that time, you are surrounded by it. You're in it every day. And at the same time, you're going through your own crisis of not even knowing what it really means, being told that you're positive, but not really knowing what that means, because we still knew so little about it. How was that for you on an internal level?
It was confusing. It was exhausting. To wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and think, oh my God, is that little red mark my first KS lesion? Am I next? I mean, there was always that underneath. Am I next?
Well, and how were people in your life around you at that time? Family members, friends, were they supportive or did they pull away? How did you experience your personal life as back then, when there was so little known, as a man with HIV?
Well, I hid it for a long time, as many people did. I was in Washington, D.C. I was brand new. I was making all new friends. I don't remember sharing it for quite some time. I for a while told myself I won't tell people until I actually have the cancer, the KS, and know I'm going to die. I'll just keep it a secret for a while. I kept it a secret at work, but somehow somebody found out or suspected something. And actually, the hospital kind of worked diligently to try and get rid of me. But I wouldn't go until I was ready to go. I knew what they were doing. They're trying to fire me for being HIV positive. And good thing they didn't, because I would have went after them full force. Hopefully I've won that lawsuit, but they didn't. They backed down because I stood up and said, you're not going to do this. I'll leave when I'm ready to leave. And this isn't right. And what they didn't like was that I had to stand up and be authentic and say, the way you're treating these patients is not right. And that's what they wanted to fire me. That's the image that they wanted to fire me for. standing up to them. But underneath it, I knew they wanted to fire me because somehow they suspected I was HIV positive as well.
And I would love to know where that came from, that at a young age, in such a vulnerable place in your life, that ability to take a stand, take on an entire institution and take a stand, where did that come from?
I think it came from my childhood. And in my childhood, I grew up in a very intimidating home. I mean, they tried to be loving. My mom certainly was loving, but my dad was an intimidator for sure. And so for most of my youth, the message to me was children should be seen, not heard. Well, when I became an adult, I freaking wanted to be heard. Nobody was going to suppress me anymore. Nobody was going to lie anymore. And I can laugh at it now, but it wasn't funny then. I kind of had a reputation of being the guy who had brutal candor. Because if Bill said it, he meant it. If you wanted an honest answer, we're going to get it from Bill. But I think I was overcompensating for those decades of in childhood of children should be seen and not heard. Oh, my dad had one of the worst military, because he grew up in the military. But he used to say, when I call for shit, you come in sliding. Those are fucking terrible messages for children to hear and grow up with. So when I became an adult, I became a verbal, don't mess with me, I'll get you if you do me wrong kind of guy. And I think it served me in some ways, made me the survivor that I am. But I think in other ways, it might have been perceived as somebody who was condescending, somebody who thought they knew it all. And so I had to modify that over the years. But to answer your question, it was from surviving my childhood, which had incest in it and a whole bunch of other things. But those things made me strong.
Yeah, there's a point when we've endured so much that we just can't endure anymore.
Yeah, you're either going to implode or you're going to explode.
Or you're going to come out swinging, you know, and you, yeah. Sounds like you came out swinging. There was a point where I came out swinging, and not so much physically, but metaphorically, I came out swinging. There was a
correct.
Point I decided I had been, had the world had wiped its feet on me enough, and no more.
Yeah. You know?
And I learned how to be intimidating.
I get it. We
overcompensate for a period of time. There was a time when, you know, I probably had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder.
Yeah, people perceiving you as arrogant or aloof. Oh my God, if I heard the word aloof anymore in my 20s and 30s, I would have just gone crazy. But I always heard aloof, and it wasn't aloof. I was just thinking about things. I was actually thinking what my next move or statement would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in your taking a stand with the hospital, did anything improve for the patients? Was there any modification of the way they were treating the patients when you took that stand?
I think ultimately things changed over time, but you know as well as I know, a big institution like that, things don't change easily. And they don't change quickly. But what I did see was people around me, nurses around me, people in the hospital around me going, he's right. And spending a few more minutes in a patient's room and being a little more empathetic and being a little more compassionate and doing all the universal precautions and then saying, well, I'm not going to get this because I took care of what I needed to take care of. And I hope that more nurses met people's needs. Yeah. I hope. I can't tell you collectively how much change, but I think sometimes when you see somebody stand up for something, there is a precipitous kind of result.
Oh, absolutely. You can't take an action like that without it having that ripple effect and affecting people. And we never know how far it goes because there's no way we can see that far. But you definitely, there's no doubt that you had an impact on the lives of those men that were coming through the hospital during that time.
And then when I left that job, I moved to Florida and I eventually ended up working for an end of life company. And we had a separate team just for people with HIV. And we gave, I think, some of the most compassionate, loving care. I mean, people will call us up and say, oh, I think I need Bill as my nurse, or, oh, I think I need Jane. I think I need this team. I really need you guys. We were changing the world a little bit.
Sounds
like not even sure we knew we were changing the world a little bit.
Well, let's circle back around to your journey, your own personal journey. I mean, I love all that you're sharing and the stories about the way you navigated what was going on in the hospital. But let's zero in a little bit more on your personal journey and how you navigated that, your own personal HIV.
Well,
and the truth that they had told you you're probably going to die, because that's what they told everybody during that time.
Of course they did. So, and unfortunately, I moved from D.C. to Florida. Fortunately, I met a wonderful man, fell in love, probably the love of my life. And I knew he was positive and he knew I was positive. Neither one of us has started medication. Then he started medication. Back then, the first one was ACT. I was not on medication because my numbers didn't indicate I needed to right then and there. I had a doctor who was, me being a nurse, was sensitive to the fact that maybe ACT was causing more problems than good. And unfortunately, that partner died in 1990 of lymphoma related to HIV.
And how long had you been together at that point?
Probably 4.5, 5 years. I bought my first home with him for $88,000 in Miami. There were heterosexual people that were jealous of our relationship. That's how tight. You know how you meet that person you're supposed to spend the rest of your life with? That was layered. And unfortunately, I spent the rest of his life with him, but kind of was left with nothing at the end. And those were really bad times. You read stories and I'm a word person, and I never really knew what the definition, I mean, I knew what wailing meant. You know, it's very poetic. Or after everybody left, he had died, everybody left, his sister was coming over to the house to pick up some of his ashes that she wanted to put in a piece of jewelry. And I remember sitting on the front porch of our home waiting for her and just wailing, living the word wailing. I didn't think more pain could come out of my voice or out of my body. And by the time his sister arrived, I was completely exhausted from, I had no voice. I had wailed it out, I thought.
And during that time of sitting on the porch and wailing, did no neighbors, nobody came?
All alone, nobody. Who would come to somebody wailing like that? You'd have to care.
You'd have to care. You'd have to be a compassionate person. But, you know, I can't imagine that there weren't neighbors that heard you.
Oh, I'm sure. And I'm sure they knew what I was wailing about. My next door neighbor was a lovely lesbian woman who I knew was home at that time. Afterwards, she said, wow, you really were crying, weren't you? And I said, yes, I was.
Wow. But she didn't set her foot outside to
No, it's scarier.
I can't imagine that. I just can't. If I heard somebody wailing, I would have to go to them. If they were a total stranger, not even my next door neighbor, a total stranger. If I heard somebody wailing, I would. There was a woman came out of the grocery store recently, and standing right in front of me, in front of the grocery store, she got the words on the telephone that somebody in her family had died. And she just started wailing. She dropped all of her groceries and just started wailing. And I went to her. I didn't know her from Adam. And there wasn't really anything I could do. I couldn't even get her to calm down enough to stop wailing. But I stood there next to her. And
that's what a sensitive, compassionate, loving person like yourself or me does, but not everybody's that way. So I can't beat her. I can't beat anybody up in the neighborhood for it. I just was in my moment and they were in theirs. And would it have been nice? Yeah, it would have been wonderful. But his sister was very loving in the moment and got it.
I mean, my heart hurts that you sat by yourself and wailed the way you're telling me that you did. That makes my heart hurt.
I'm sure people in the Ukraine are wailing. You know what I mean? There's a lot of hurt in the world. There's a lot of pain in the world. And as much as I would have loved support and other people to be there, like maybe his family, although the sister came, the mother and other people left in a truck full of stuff that was his, but was ours. It was terrible to watch that truck go with things we both cherished, but that's the person she was. Let's pack up my son's stuff and let's get out of Dodge.
Wow.
Yeah. But, you know, my story's not unique. There were many, many, many stories like that where people were, you know, their lover was just torn out of the house after they died. And
yes, I've heard some of those stories. Yeah. You are right.
So I don't feel like I'm special. I just feel like I'm happy I survived it.
How did you get through that loss in that time period?
Well, alcohol.
So you medicated yourself. A quick run
with some drugs. And it wasn't much longer after he had died, April 5th, that I got a call from some friends of my brother's, a gay male. One of my brothers was gay. And they say, your brother's in an intensive care unit. He has AIDS, he has cancer, and we think he's dying. So I leave my job and my home, and I go to Denver, Colorado to take care of my brother until he dies. And he dies July 17th. So Laird dies April 5th, Roger dies July 17th. And then while I'm in Denny, Scotland, months later, bringing my ashes of my partner Laird back to his grandparents' home, another friend of mine dies. And I mean, it's just 1990 was terrible, just a terrible year. Yeah, and then things got better a little bit after that. Time. Pardon?
There was still a lot of death going on at that time.
My grandmother had died in March. My mother called me up and she said, Willie, you got to come home. Your grandmother died. And I said, Ma, I can't come home. She's like, why? I said, Laird woke up this morning and half of his face is paralyzed. And she says, why? And I said, because his cancer is now in his brain. So I didn't go home for my grandmother's funeral because I was busy getting my partner taken care of.
Wow.
And he got whole brain radiation. He did really well for a short period of time. We went on vacation to the Oregon coast, had a great time, came back, and within 2 weeks he was gone.
Well, what a beautiful thing that you got that special time together right there.
Very special time. Yeah.
Wow.
And I actually quit my job taking care of people for a good 5 years. and actually went into a career that I'm still do to this day. I became an actor, writer, director, producer. I took a break from it all, and I think maybe 4 or 5 year break. And then I eventually went back. And then in my 50s, I was a caregiver for my mom, who was with dementia. And I went and got my master's degree. And then I went into teaching, and I actually taught end of life care. And it was interesting to be all those decades later and teaching young students, nursing students, who really had no understanding of what it was like. Didn't know what ACT UP was, just had no history and hadn't been taught any of it either.
Well, yeah, the young ones don't really know at all what the people of the 80s and 90s went through. So nope. How long was it before you realized that you probably weren't going to die like they had told you?
I think I lived with the fear of dying for a good 10, maybe 12 years. And then the heart treatments came out and I realized, oh my God, I might actually live. And then I went back into the work market and I went back into being a nurse and I went full steam ahead. But I was lost with some drugs and alcohol. There was a suicide, a failed suicide attempt there in the middle of it all. I had some leftover drugs from Laird's.
You said fatal. What do you mean?
Failed.
Oh, failed. I thought you said
failed.
I was like, okay, was fatal, please explain. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I do have one guest that his last suicide attempt was successful. He coded and they were able to bring him back. He literally died and they were able to bring him back. His last attempt. He had attempted over 10 times in his lifetime.
I think mine was a cry out for help more than anything.
Which is, a lot of them are that way.
Of course.
A lot of them are cries for help. They're not really people wanting to end their lives.
And like being on the porch, I kind of wish that people had saw it coming, but they didn't, or I didn't allow them to see it. That might have been the other part too. You know, being a strong person sometimes can be an advantage and a disadvantage. But when I realized that this little contract I made with God or the universe or Buddha, Allah, whatever you call it, I begged and said, please spare me. I'll take care of every person with every molecule, every cell I have, and love them and care for them and give them the best. Just spare me. When those heart medicines came out and we were now living longer, I kind of realized whatever deal I made with the universe, it worked.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because here you are 40 some odd years later.
42 years later. Yeah, here I am.
And still
working on stigma around it.
But honestly, you know, you look like the picture of health. Nobody would ever look at you and tell that you're HIV positive. And that's not the case. A lot of times you can tell.
Oh, yeah.
You can tell.
And you know what?
I don't see that on you at all.
I don't lose too much weight purposely, because if I do lose too much weight, I'll start seeing a little concavity or concaveness here. And I'll think, oh my God, I look like I'm HIV. Do you believe 42 years later, I'm worried that I still might look like HIV. So don't lose too much weight.
I think that makes sense. I mean, nobody wants to look like they're sick, regardless of what the illness or disease is.
Sure.
I want to back up for a minute. You said something a minute ago that I'd like to unpack, because I think this may be valuable for at least some of the listeners. You said, I wish that, you know, somebody had foreseen the space that I was in. And then you said, perhaps I didn't let them. And I would love for you to unpack that a little bit more, because I think it's important for us to realize that oftentimes we live in this space where we think people should just magically, intuitively, or they're mind readers and they should know what we're going through. And life doesn't really work that way. So tell me a little bit more about, because what I hear you, not in so many words, but what I hear you doing when you said that was taking some responsibility for your experience. And that's a powerful place to operate from. Instead of playing the victim and going, there I was wailing on the porch and nobody ever even came out of their house, or and that's the victim story. But the non-victim story, the story of responsibility, is saying, and perhaps maybe those people didn't come out of their house because I had shown up so strong, so self-sufficient, and I didn't let people see what was going on with me. Can you tell me more about that? I think that's just something valuable to call out for whoever's listening right now. And this applies to not just the loss of a partner. It can apply to anything where we are traumatized and we've had our, you know, we've been sucker punched.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a combination of physical, mental, spiritual, but we often put out the opposite signals, or I can just speak for myself, but I see it in other people as well. And I'm thinking they're lying. The subtext underneath what they're saying is not what they're saying. They're miserable. They're unhappy. And I was miserable, sad, unhappy, fearful. I was a wreck.
What was the fear?
But don't let him see it. Don't let him see you sweat. I don't know.
What was the fear that kept you from letting them see that sweat? Because I felt emotion rush up in you in that moment when you said what you just said.
Yeah. Probably just, I've realized this multiple times in my life, but I'm realizing it one more time again. I was a sickly child who was pitied and the sissy and the weakling. And I didn't want to feel that again.
You didn't want to be perceived that way.
I didn't want to be little Willie, the sickly little boy that everybody had to take care of. And he couldn't run. He couldn't do this. And he would get a wheeze. He would have asthma. He couldn't eat this because he had allergies and he was skinny. And I don't know. I think because I was a sickly child, I felt useless as a human being. And I did, to be honest, didn't want anybody's pity. I didn't want to feel those feelings again. I had grown out of them, I thought. I'd grown up.
I think that's the key word, you thought.
Thought.
Yeah. Because it's, I felt it in you a minute ago when you said that. I could feel, literally feel the little boy inside of you having all that come present right there.
Yeah. Room. That little boy is still troubled. You never heal him completely. Or at least I haven't. I'm not even sure there's a way to heal that completely when you're that traumatized, when you've survived incest and a whole bunch of other things. And then to, you know, when the AIDS epidemic happened, I was 33 years old and a widower. That's not supposed to happen. I'm 66 now. Maybe now I could be a widower and don't want to be, but I could be. And now I'm reliving those days in a completely different way. Nobody should be a widower at 33. Nobody. I'm just figuring out what the hell I'm, who I am at 33. Not this wailing, grieving, traumatized, injured person who's probably going to struggle for the next few years to just do anything possible. Well,
I can feel that's really still very present for you.
Very.
I'm an empath. I can feel that.
I was a sensitive child, so I understand your sensitivity too. It was torture. on certain days and beauty on others.
Yes, that makes sense. That it's a double-edged sword.
Oh, completely, completely. But I do love where I am right now. I do love being 66 years old and having survived so many things. And I only hope that words and speaking up and speaking out can impact others.
Oh, absolutely.
In a positive way.
Absolutely. So I'd love to hear a little bit more. I mean, we've heard all of the stuff that you survived, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about where you are now. What's life like now? Because you're kind of on the other side of, at least to some degree, most of that. You'll carry some of it for the rest of your life in memories, and there'll always be feelings.
It's but actually
the situation
pretty
themselves you're on the side of.
Yeah, it's actually pretty wonderful to finally be on the other side of it all. You know, you always say, "Oh, well, there's a light at the end of the tunnel." Man, that was a long, dark tunnel. But I kept taking steps forward, and life has sort of broken out. And you can look at Erickson's stages of life, but I'm old enough now that even in my 50s, when I went back and got my master's, I thought I can teach a new generation things that hopefully they won't have to experience. And they'll learn the lesson instead of having to go through the whole situation.
What was the one thing that allowed you to continue on in that very, very long, dark tunnel? You went for a long time believing that there was going to be light at some point, and for a long time there wasn't light, and yet you kept going. What was the one thing that enabled you to do that?
I didn't want to waste my life. There's a purpose to everybody's life. There's a purpose when a sperm meets an egg. As soon as you're conceived, there's purpose. And I just felt if I gave up, I wouldn't fulfill the one or multiple purposes.
So you
I was created for.
Are you telling me that you knew that there was still something for you to, something of great value for you to do here?
Yes.
And that was the thing that kept you moving forward in that long, dark tunnel?
Yep. Because I could still hear myself breathing, and I could still hear my heart beating, even if it all felt hollow and dark and senseless. I thought, I have to go on. I'm alive. There's a reason you're alive. Keep going, 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 going.
Was there a point when you discovered what that purpose that you were moving toward was? Are you still on that path and have not fully discovered what that purpose is?
I think I'm still on that path, but certainly during those dark, dark, terrible days in the decades in the tunnel, or at least one decade where I thought I was going to die because the light would go out in the tunnel. I live the purpose in taking care of people with my entire soul and being. I worked in end-of-life care and palliative care for decades on and off. I felt I was touched and blessed to offer that gift as a nurse, to be somebody's last friend, last confidant, to be able to understand what it is to give somebody a good death, because I think most of us don't understand what that means, can't wrap our minds around that. So I had an excellent career, and now my dream is to fuse the humanity I've lived, some of it not pretty, and to fuse that with the art that I'm working on. Even though there's an art to nursing, as an actor, writer, director, producer, I want to bring humanity into my art. Not to say it's not there already, but any art that I do moving forward still has to have that level of humanity within it. And as a director, I certainly have worked very closely with actors to pull that humanity out. So I'm just continuing my quest. I'm continuing doing what I'm doing. I'm working on one-on-one. If it's just a conversation with one person, like if I wore this t-shirt that says, this is what HIV looks like, and I was in a grocery store and some lady looked at me and said, hey, what's that all about? And I had a conversation with her, then I would still be living my purpose.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
So I'm fortunate that I found that and I understand my purpose. I don't always do it every day. You know, I'd be annoying.
I love the way you worded when you're directing and working with the actors that your intention is to draw the humanity out in them. Because in that moment, I realized that when I'm having these conversations with my guests on the podcast, I would have never thought to word it that way, but that's exactly what I'm intending to do, is to draw the humanity out in my guests so the listeners can experience that humanity.
Because and you're not intending to do it. My friend, you are actually doing it. You may not be doing it all the time, but you're doing it at the right times, at the right moments when it needs to be done. That's what empathic, sensitive, loving, compassionate, caring people do. That's why there's no accident that I'm here now and you're there now. There's no accident to this. Was meant to be.
I am receiving that. Thank you for that, Bill.
Good.
I'm very touched in this moment. Thank you. Well, you have an incredible story, and you are in a place where there's light in that tunnel now.
Oh, sunshine.
So if you were going to drop a wisdom bomb on the listener, because we both know that there are certainly men out there, our gay brothers, that are in that dark tunnel, and they don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. If there was a wisdom bomb that you could share to give them strength, to give them hope, to give them perseverance, what would that be?
I guess if you can't find a light, or you see that light is going away, ask for help, reach out, grab for a light, wail, scream for a light, and maybe somebody will answer. But if you don't make it audible, nobody's going to read your mind, and the light's going to go out, and you're just going to go down the tunnel in the abyss, and you'll be gone, and you'll have missed. We, the others outside and around you, will have missed the opportunity to help, to save, to maybe help you reinvent yourself.
You know, what came to me intuitively a moment ago was, when you're in that dark tunnel and you can't see the light and you can't find the light, perhaps it's because you're meant to be the light.
That's pretty profound. Yeah. I think we are the light sometimes, and we just don't get it.
Well, there is no way possible that you weren't the light for many of the people that you have treated over your career as a healthcare professionals.
Thousands of people. And I think about them occasionally.
Touched. And you, even when you were in your own dark tunnel, you were the light for many of those people. You know, when we can't see the light, we can't find the light. Maybe it's because the universe is waiting for us to be the light.
Yeah. No, I think that's, I think you hit the nail on the head there for sure. For sure. And you have to remind yourself, Eva, I have to remind myself every once in a while. And you just did. You are the light.
Yeah.
Shine.
We do have to remind ourselves, because no matter how bright we shine, we go through dark periods ourselves.
We're human.
We're human. We're absolutely human. Well, this has been an honor and a pleasure to have this conversation with you. And it's been certainly a beautiful journey, a beautiful story. And your energy, for somebody that has been through all that you have been through, your energy has a lightness to it, Bill.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Lightness to it and a brightness to it. I would say that you're completely on purpose.
That's a huge compliment. That's a huge validation of something I know, but often need to be reminded, hey, you're on point.
Well, I'm very intuitive and I pick up on things and I'm reading your energy and I'm feeling that. I'm feeling like you perhaps have not fully given yourself the credit that you deserve for all that you have done and all that you continue to do.
And moments like these and opportunities like these are great opportunities for a person to actually hear themselves. And so, excuse me, when this gets posted and I get to listen to it again, I get to reflect and acknowledge some things that I don't normally, you know, do. So in the hopes of helping and touching and reaching others, at the same time, the other end of that is, yeah, you're doing what you need to do. And you may have a bunch of judgments on how you could do it better or whatever, but you're doing the right thing. The flow is the right thing that's happening. And to be 66 and doing it and thinking, oh, if I live as long as my mother, I got another 30 years of doing this.
There you go.
Lucky me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Gosh, I had a thought and it just went out of my head. What was I thinking? Oh, well, it's gone. It'll either come back or what.
Well, you can text me later. Oh, here it is.
Let's move into rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
I am.
Ready as you're going to be, huh?
You got it. And I don't think you can be ready for these.
So if you could go back in time to any time of your choice, but a younger time in your life, and you could say anything that you wanted to say to the younger version of you, what would you tell him? How old would he be, and what would you tell him?
I would tell my sophomore year in high school self that you were born for the stage. Just do it. In whatever way, shape, or form, don't let anybody say you can't. You can do it.
Beautiful. I love it. And I love the way I just saw your energy light up as you said that.
Yeah.
All right. Many years from now, you are a ghost at your own funeral. And you're looking at all of the people that have attended your funeral. And there is a bevy of your gay male peers there, what do you hope they'll say about you in remembrance?
My epithet should say brutal candor. He was honest.
He spoke the truth.
With integrity. And a smile.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
for sure. And final question, what is your superpower?
Oh, my superpower? I don't share this much. But it's picking up on people's truth very quickly. And it's been an advantage in all of my careers.
So you read people really well?
Yeah.
Beautiful.
When other people just miss everything, and it's so obvious to me, and what a gift.
Yes, I have been gifted with something very, very similar, and
I know you know it.
Yes, it's made life much different than it would have been if I'd have been clueless. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I have a thing about being clueless.
I guess what was coming to me a minute ago that I couldn't remember was that I just wanted to say two things I want to leave you with. One is that with all my heart, I hope that as a result of being here today as a guest, that you feel truly seen and heard.
Namaste. Yes.
And the other thing is to let you know that in my eyes, you are indeed an authentic gay man.
Thank you. That's good to hear. And coming from you, because I do consider my sources, that is an ultimate compliment. And I respect it and I take it in.